You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 443 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we're coming to you in different locations. I'm in Seattle, Washington, home of the four-time WNBA champion Storm.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Again, you're doing it wrong. Home of the first place.
There we go.
Seattle Seahawks, all
and
alone
first place.
In first place, entering this Sunday's showdown rematch against the Arizona Cardinals. We're going to talk about Seahawks Jets in a little bit here as part of our weekend recap. But first, it's a good thing that we did not record until Wednesday because a lot of news regarding the Seattle Storm on Wednesday. And we wanted to hit that kind of right at the top as it has been breaking. And I've been writing about some of it. So Wednesday afternoon, the Storm released a statement to us at ESPN and other outlets on the investigation that was done of the coaching staff that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. Here's that statement. The Storm recently received internal allegations of potential workplace policy violations. The organization returned an outside investigator to conduct an impartial investigation into the allegations. The investigation has been completed, and there were no findings of policy violations or any discrimination, harassment, or bullying. To protect the integrity of the process and to preserve confidentiality, we chose not to comment while the investigation was ongoing. The Storm will continue to provide a work environment in which all individuals are treated with respect. So this was kind of, I think, an unsurprising conclusion to this situation that, you know, we didn't necessarily learn any details from this statement, just that there were no violations of policy. But things escalated shortly thereafter when the Chicago Sun-Times, which originally broke this story about the investigation, reported that All-Star guard Jewel Lloyd was the player who filed the complaint, and her, quote, future in Seattle was contingent upon a belief that relationships within the organization could be mended. As a result of the determination of the investigation, the Sun-Times reported that Lloyd has asked out of Seattle for a trade, which we at ESPN, Alexa Phillip, who wrote that story for us, were able to confirm later on Wednesday. So huge news is the number one pick of the 2015 draft, who's played her entire season in Seattle, was the star around whom the Storm built after Breanna Stewart left for the New York and Sue Bird retired, now wants out of Seattle.
Okay. Is there any more to say about the allegations piece, or is the basic thinking this was Jewel Lloyd, who obviously has been disgruntled based upon this information from what we're hearing after, disgruntled with the coaching staff, and that's not going to reach any conclusion here in Seattle, and so it's an obvious point for a separation between the two.
Yeah, I mean, that's it was not really a secret that the Jewel Lloyd was, you know, kind of the player who had raised these allegations based on, you know, some of the social media posts and things around this. But, you know, for it's different to now have that factually reported. And, you know, again, clearly the reason that she raised those allegations is that she was displeased with the coaching staff and the way that she was coached last season. And if nothing came of that investigation, then apparently she would prefer to play elsewhere.
Okay, so Jewel Lloyd has requested a trade. Is there any more backstory on this? The last season, it felt like Jewel Lloyd, the previous season in the 2023 season, Jewel Lloyd was the Storm star, right?
Yeah.
And 2024, they go out, they make two big free agent signings. Jewel Lloyd did not have the same kind of season that I think she or anybody around the league was expecting from her.
And I think the thing about this is, look, she was involved in recruiting Skylar Diggins-Smith and Neko Ogwumike to Seattle as free agents. She was, you know, after signing an extension at the end of the 2023 season, she could have been a free agent herself. She's coming off a year where the Storm were in the lottery, were rebuilding for a short period of time, but I think was sold in part on the plan to go out and add veterans to compete. Well, you know, she's coming off a season where she set the all-time WNBA record for total points, taking advantage of the elongated season that was subsequently surpassed by Asia Wilson last year. And she also was involved in Pokey Chapman getting elevated to assistant GM, her increased role in the organization, as well as an assistant coach. So, Jewel Lloyd carried a lot of weight in the organization at that point. And then, there were high expectations from her and from everybody involved. And even though I think people are a little too down on the season, we've talked about this. I think the Storm played about as well as you could have reasonably expected. And it just turned out that the rest of the top of the WNBA was better than expected. But yeah, individually, it was not the season that you would have expected from Jewel Lloyd. And, I think one thing that happened is in 2023, she had to really, change her shot diet to adjust for the fact that Brianna Stewart and Sue Bird weren't around to create offense. And you were playing, without an experienced point guard or even any traditional point guard much of the season. And so, the fact that she shot 37% from the field, 38% on twos that season, that was understandable given the high usage rate that she was carrying. And, she had a usage rate of 33% in 2023. In 2024, with so much talent around her, that usage rate goes down to 29%. Her efficiency, though, instead of rebounding to where it had been previously, when she was playing with Sue and Stewie, is instead the worst of her career. And, I think her shot selection didn't reflect the fact that there were a lot more options on offense. And, what's sad about this is, look, we don't know what was being said behind closed doors in the locker room in regards to these allegations, but publicly, Joelle Quinn went out of her way to have Jewel Lloyd's back and never question her shot selection at a point when I don't know that I would have been able to be so diplomatic were I in the same position.
Okay. I mean, I guess that's how we got here, but looking forward, what is next? What are the possible options for, obviously it's not a massive league, but what are the possible options for trade for the Storm right now?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see sort of how this evolves. I think there will be a lot of teams that are interested in Jewel Lloyd. The number one team that I would look at, and we're going to have a story about this on ESPN.com, very likely Thursday, is the Las Vegas Aces. So Jewel Lloyd is represented by Clutch Sports. Clutch Sports' other WNBA clients include Asia Wilson, Chelsea Gray, Jackie Young, three of the stars for the Las Vegas Aces, and
Just like welcome to the NBA, WNBA. This whole story is such a just it is this is you're here now. It is happening. The Transact is becoming the story across the WNBA. And this feels like such an NBA moment that's happening. Even to be able to tie in clutch of all like agencies, yes, but clutch
yes.
of all agencies being part of it with the team like Vegas, which is sort of the super team or whatever, right?
One of the two. By the
Wanting
way,
to.
did we mention on the pod that Jewel is playing with Brianna Stewart and Courtney Vanderson? We did mention that in the Unrivaled League.
But having that kind of gravity and this trade request, this to me feels like this is like point one on the dominoes of the WNBA go moving toward the NBA, right? It is maybe there's further ones, but this is a big trade request in those dominoes for WNBA Transact. And
It is a very public trade request by WNBA standards. Like, there's been a lot of trade requests, but usually they operate more quietly behind the scenes before they're fulfilled.
so, okay, if it is the Aces, what does a package look like? And I guess my question for you, even more than the individuals, is there have been two different types of trades that have happened in the NBA. There's the of trades under duress, right? Where the team basically needs to make a trade. Sometimes people have gotten fair market value for those trades, or even exceeded fair market value because teams want to go out and get stars. Other times they haven't gotten the kind of package that they otherwise would have because the trading teams know that they're basically needing to trade this player. And I know that's something that we're not going to know exactly right now, but I'm curious about the individual packages and how much you view, like on a pendulum or whatever, you think they're going to be able to go out and find the same value that they would have had they wanted to trade Jewel Lloyd, say last offseason.
I mean, I don't think it's the same as last offseason because then Jewel Lloyd was coming off a much better season.
Or maybe not same as last offseason without the trade
Yeah.
request.
So n this is something that my buddies Nate Duncan and Danny LaRue talked about a lot on the Dunked On Basketball NBA podcast is there's two sources of leverage. There's internal leverage, which is like, we're not going to trade this player if we don't think the package is good enough. And when there's a trade request, the internal leverage is not as high, but the external leverage still exists of other teams competing to get the player. And
Okay.
so I would think of the Damian Lillard scenario, where there weren't that many teams that realistically could have traded for Damian Lillard. He obviously wanted to go to the Miami Heat, but the Milwaukee Bucks came in, and because of that external leverage of him going being traded to another team, were willing to give Portland, you know, multiple draft picks and Jrue Holiday and Grayson Allen. So, you know, Portland, I think, ended up doing pretty well out of that trade. You know,
does
maybe
Joel
not
Lloyd have that kind of gravity right now?
Not at the same level as Damian Lillard, but I mean, I think Las Vegas in particular seems like a team that might be highly motivated to go get her. I think there probably will be, you know, one or two other teams in that boat. It'll be interesting
I mean,
to see.
Again, it's not a big league. It's not like there's a difference between the NBA where you have, you know, 30 different options. In the WNBA, there just aren't that many teams.
But like the other issue for the Storm is it's a little more difficult than to construct kind of a player for player trade in the WNBA. But the Aces present an interesting situation here. Their players have almost always extended before they've hit free agency, you know, typically for much less than they could have made, you know, in terms of the supermax or even the maximum salary. Kelsey Plum did not choose to extend this past season, is an unrestricted free agent. So the Aces can core her, but if Kelsey Plum were interested in moving on and were interested in coming back to where she started in college, let's say, like, That's a framework that
don't
would be
tempt
very
me here. Do not tempt me. I'm saying
to,
we're in wildest dream scenario
trying
right
to speak
now.
It into existence
a little bit, right?
Look, she's already gonna be back here on January 18th for the jersey retirement at UW. Let's just make the announcement happen then too.
Do you think that's actually a realistic thing, or is that?
I don't know where Kelsey Plum wants to play, and you know, even if she's under core designations, she'll have some say in where she wants to go.
Why would she not want to be in Vegas anymore?
People want different opportunities. I don't know. I mean, we'll see, but it's not something that's just like.
And what would that mean for Skylar? Do they play well together, Skylar Diggins-Smith and Kelsey Plum? Like
Plum is pretty much a shooting guard at this point.
She
I mean,
could
Chelsea
play
Gray is
off
the point
ball.
Guard in Las Vegas. And even Jackie Young really handled the point guard duties when Chelsea Gray was out at the start of this season.
So you think it would be a good fit in Seattle?
You'd have a little smaller backcourt than you would prefer. You're getting smaller by swapping Jrue Holiday for Kelsey Plum. But
is that
like,
okay.
That's the best player realistically you're going to get in trade in return for her. Unless
how old
it's,
is Jrue Holiday? Like, what is the age difference between the two? Fairly close?
It is fairly close. Jrue is 31. Kelsey Plum is 30.
Okay. So not that far off in terms. It's not like, do you think, let's say that a package materialized around Kelsey Plum, which again, I'm treating this as, this is wishful thinking, right? This is wish casting a little bit for Kelsey Plum. But do the Storm have to include a pick with Jrue Holiday, or value-wise, is that a one-for-one swap? What does that look like?
I would say Las Vegas would probably try to get something else, just given that they would not have, you know, necessarily this the same leverage of a trade request.
Does Jrue Holiday make the Aces better? Is that addition?
I mean, they'd be really big and strong defensively. They would lose certainly some shooting if Lloyd doesn't bounce back from the way she shot it last season.
Okay, what about other options besides?
So Chicago is obviously going to come up. That's Jewel's hometown. Where she still lives during the off season.
Okay, I was wondering why the Chicago Sun-Times was reporting this. I was like, what business?
I mean,
that makes
Annie
sense.
Constable, the reporter who's broken this news, is also very plugged in on stories throughout the league. She's one of the handful of WNBA reporters that travels to cover road games on a regular basis. So, you know, I don't know that I would necessarily say it's a one-to-one correlation there, but
it doesn't hurt.
So Chicago, player-wise on the roster, wouldn't have a lot to offer. It would probably have to be something built around draft picks, and they do have, you know, a pair of first-round picks this year, including the number 3 overall pick.
Is Jrue Holiday worth the number 3 overall pick right now? That's what I'm trying to grasp. I'm trying to think about it, and it's really difficult because the number 3 pick doesn't mean the same thing in the WNBA as it means in the NBA, but does that feel like a reasonable trade?
It's not unreasonable. I mean, I would think is, you know, a decent comparison for Jrue Holiday would be the former Sky leading scorer, Kalia Copper, who averaged 21.1 points per game last year in Phoenix. You know, the Sky traded her. I think she had potentially requested a trade. I'd have to double check that. But, you know, they got a pair of first round picks for
okay.
her.
Have we seen a package similar to some of the NBA packages that maybe aren't quite as common anymore, but there's the period where everybody was trading multiple future first round picks? Have we seen anything like that in the WNBA where it's
you
three
can't...
firsts, or what are the rules around that?
So that you can only trade draft picks up to 3 years out.
Okay.
So right now you could trade 25, 26, 27, and you have to keep at least one of them, or have to have at least one first round pick, I should say.
Okay.
So a team that had extra first round picks could hypothetically trade, you know, three or maybe even four, but therefore we haven't typically seen more than two. Like one of the biggest packages was Marina Mabry a couple of years ago. Also, she went to Chicago for two first round picks in a swap in between.
I mean, that's an interesting package. And do you think that's something that if the Storm presented that, basically three firsts with the pick swap in between?
I don't know that they would get that much.
If it's two, let's say it's a 25 first round, a good 25 first round pick, or could you trade 26 and 27 together?
Weirdly, they can't trade 26 picks because they're swapped, and you can't trade swapped picks.
Oh my God. Okay.
But they could
Chicago
trade.
Chicago can't, but other teams could.
Correct.
Can a team, hypothetically speaking, not Chicago, trade consecutive years of picks 26 and 27 is what my question is.
Yes.
Okay.
As long as they retain their 25 or have an extra pick.
Is that something that to the Storm, I don't want to say that they're rebuilding, but we've talked about this a lot. And
they would not rebuild. I mean,
I'm not saying that they're rebuilding. Right now, they do not necessarily have a championship roster, given how top-heavy the WNBA is. A little bit of the hope is that they end up with the Sparks lottery pick next season, right?
Correct.
Maybe not even a little bit, maybe a lot bit of the hope, the long-term hope of becoming a championship contender relies on that pick. So they have a roster that probably even without Jewel Lloyd, they can compete to be in the playoffs next season and probably the season after that behind. When is basically the free agency onslaught? Is that after the 25 season?
Correct. That's okay. The 2026 free agency.
So that is going to be just endgame, right?
You also need to think about Neko Gumike as a free agent. You need to put together a roster that's going to convince Neko Gumike.
Neko Gumike is a free agent right now.
Correct.
Okay. So you have to convince Neko Gumike. These probably still have, just given the history of her being here, an inside shot at NECA.
She has spoken very positively about Seattle. She was on Sue Bird and Megan Rapinoe's podcast a few weeks back, talked about her incredible connection with Noel Quinn, playing for a former player, largely a contemporary of hers, and what that sort of, you know, she didn't even realize what that would mean to her until she had that experience. So it sounded very much like someone who is playing for the Storm for Noel Quinn.
And the Storm is able to give her the max or whatever.
Yes.
So still a good shot that happens, but is loading up on picks. Have teams done this in the WNBA that much yet?
No, I wouldn't say that there's a team but I think Washington is attempting to. So,
I mean, it is, look, we can see what's happening in Oklahoma and understand it is the right strategy.
Well, you know, who sees what's happening in Oklahoma?
Who is
Oklahoma
that?
Is, the Wizards president of basketball, Monumental Sports president of basketball, who oversees both the Wizards and the Mystics, Michael Winger, who made the decision to let go of the Tebows and bring in new management this offseason. And the indication is that they plan to pursue an Oklahoma City style rebuild. And he was previously in Oklahoma City.
I mean,
he didn't start his career, but was under Sam Presti.
I have some critiques of that, because the thing that Oklahoma City had that basically nobody else has is the assets, right? They had the players to be able to turn them into the picks. If you don't have those, it's much harder said than done.
I
right?
agree with that. But I'm saying, if you're looking at a team that is trying to pursue that, Washington
it is
going to
Mystics
be it. So I think one thing you would think of, if it's a trade to a team like Chicago, where the return would be primarily pick-based, I think Washington would be a really interesting partner in a three-team swap. They don't really have a lot of star-level talent, but they have a number of really good role players who could be useful for the Storm.
So you're saying basically Jewel Lloyd goes to Chicago, picks go to Washington, players come to the Storm.
Correct. So Carly Samuelson is someone who the Storm actually had her for a hot second before she developed into a credible rotation player, is now one of the league's best shooters. Stephanie Dolson had a really nice season as a stretch five for Washington as someone who could, you know, be part of a front court backing up both Ezi Magbogore and Neko Okumeke. Brittany Sykes is one of the league's best defenders and an improved shooter. So, you know, those are, if you were looking at it as like Neko Okumeke and Skylar Diggins-Smith and Ezi Magbogore, whose name we haven't said yet, those are going to be your go-to offensive options, then those Washington players could maybe support them with more shooting than you had last year.
Okay. What is, if you were in charge of the situation, right? You obviously don't know the packages that are out there. Basically looking at it as these two different options of you can go find players, you can go find picks. That's they will probably have those two different paths.
Yeah.
Without knowing the specifics, what do you feel like is the right path for the Storm to take in this moment, knowing that they're probably needing to trade Jewel Loyd?
I think what they are doing right now, where it's sort of a mixed strategy, where obviously they had this very veteran roster last year, but they also have this 2026 LA pick. And particularly 2026 and 2027, like the thing about the 2025 draft, and that's why you asked whether Jewel Loyd was worth the number three pick, and I think that will come into more focus by January, because we'll have a better idea of what the draft is going to look like, who's going to be in it, how coveted those players are. I would say right now, the excitement about the 2025 draft is really strong at the top if Paige Bueckers comes out. Beyond Paige Bueckers, it's not quite as strong, I would say. So the number three pick might not be, you know, as exciting as having someone's unprotected pick in 2026 or 2027 when you're talking about, you know, potentially Juju Watkins being in those drafts, depending on what happens with the age limit.
You're not going to be able to flip a couple of picks for somebody like Juju Watkins. It's still hoping for the lottery.
Yeah,
hoping to
of course, but as many, the more shots you have at it, the better.
I mean, to be able to get...
You couldn't get Chicago's 2026 pick, but, you know, if you could get Chicago's 2027 pick and something else and flip the something else for veterans, that's kind of a mixed strategy.
Okay. I mean, we've talked about this quite a bit around the Storm and basically just trying to understand exactly what they're doing. But every team in the league is in this position when you have, you know, more or less, when you have three to four teams. Last year, we would have said two. Right now, there's three to four teams that could probably compete for a championship. But when the league is so top heavy, there are a lot of teams that are in a position of kind of like, what are we doing right now if we don't have one of those star players?
And one of the things we've talked about is just like the other element of it is wanting to capitalize financially on the growth of the league and the excitement about the league.
And I mean, that's going to happen anyway. Literally,
having
just
a competitive roster,
by being present, they will capitalize.
Having a competitive roster changes it. The excitement about the Storm was different last year than it was in 2023. Or was different than it was in Los Angeles, let's say, where they didn't draw the same other than the Indiana game, you know.
Uh-huh. I mostly agree with that, but the rising tide is going to lift a lot of ships.
I mean, the
in
other
this
thing,
scenario,
like some of these teams, I guess I will say it may not matter as much because they've got, you know, a 10,000 seat arena to sell. Like Dallas has already sold out of season tickets after they got the number one pick. They can't sell anymore other than games that they maybe move to the American Airlines.
Because basically
Center.
You're just like, we're drafting Paige Bueckers.
That's why people are buying the season tickets, because
yeah,
they expect that she's coming. The Storm play in an arena where they could sell 20,000 seats a night if they were really capable of it. So there is more upside for them than there is for some of these teams in smaller arenas.
Okay, I guess one last question on this. Is a team, let's say a Kelsey Plum trade materializes, and let's say it's a one-to-one swap, right? Because, or whatever, we don't know any other specifics.
The Storm throws in this year's first round pick or something.
The roster is mostly the same as the 2024 roster, and it's Kelsey Plum.
I would say the starting lineup is mostly the same. The bench is going to obviously have a very different look either way.
Is that team able to compete with the Lynx and the Liberty and the Aces?
You'd need to get lucky. You need like Jordan Horstin to have a breakout or something like that.
Even still.
I think so. But like, We also don't know that all of those teams are going to be as good as they were this season. And Connecticut is a team that, you know, we don't know what direction they're sort of heading. They have a number of free agents. They just hired a new head coach today who has no WNBA, no American coaching experience. So there are some variables out there. And I think, Like, so much, one of my things is like, so much things felt so different last year because the Storm of the Fifth Seed in plain Las Vegas. Had they been, had it set up differently and, Connecticut didn't have the season that they had, let's say, and the Storm were the fourth seed hosting Connecticut. I think back to 2022 where the Storm were in a similar position, but they got the fourth seed, had home court against Washington, swept them in the first round, and then were toe to toe with the Aces in the playoffs.
But that team had Breonna Stewart. I'm sorry. Like, there's any time that you have Breonna Stewart.
But I'm saying
you
this
are
year's
a championship
team,
contender.
Last year's team won as many games.
But it doesn't matter. Sometimes you can win as many games. Like, this happens in the NBA all the time, where it's like you win this many games, but realistically speaking, there is finite amount of teams that can win the championship.
Sure, I agree that would not still have been capable of winning the championship, but the championship is not the only thing that matters. Which is why we say that I don't know, the Storm have only lost in the semifinals once, so we can't say 5-time semifinalists. It's not as interesting. But if they were like 10-time semifinalists, that might be interesting. Well, we'll get to a team that mastered the semifinals this year later in the pod. Seattle Sounders.
Oh. That shows how dialed in I am on that. It is so funny. This weekend felt like on Sunday morning. And in fact, I will say Sunday, like midway through the second quarter of the Seahawks game, it felt like it was a weekend that maybe you had said it would be the greatest sports weekend in Seattle sports history. Things obviously changed. But it is funny that you couple in there one of the Storm's biggest stars requesting a trade right after. This doesn't feel as cataclysmic to me. And maybe that's because of the different role that Jewel Lloyd played last season. This doesn't feel like it doesn't fundamentally change my perspective of where the Storm are right now.
Yeah, I mean, look, let's be realistic. Jewel Lloyd was the Storm's fourth best player last season.
After NECA, Skylar Diggins-Smith, and Ezzie.
Correct.
I mean, I think you have to factor in. I don't know if that's exactly fair to Jewel Lloyd, because yes, it's one season, but I do think you have to factor in some of the skill level, and she has played at an extremely high level. Like, just because she played that way last year doesn't necessarily mean that she would next season. And maybe that's one of the positives for the Storm overall in that scenario, is if you add a Kelsey Plum and you're talking about, like, if that's your top four, that's a pretty strong top four.
Yeah.
So
this remains an SMA core pod.
Well,
so anyways, the WNBA expansion draft is on Friday.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Golden State Valkyries will have some players. I have a mock expansion draft up on ESPN.com on Thursday. The Storm in the mock expansion draft lose their third round pick in 2024. Indiana forward Mackenzie Holmes, who did not play this season after knee surgery.
A mock expansion draft is literally what you live for. This is Uh-oh. Christmas Day for you.
Yeah.
Christmas came early for ESPN senior writer
Kevin
Felton.
Not just a mock expansion draft, a mock expansion draft with multiple trades.
Oh, hello. There it is.
Give me I was going to say the Vince McMahon meme, but the meme is still good.
When is Toronto coming to the league? Is that the next season?
Yes, Toronto and Portland are coming online in 2026.
Okay. So you're already getting excited about that one.
Oh, a two-team mock expansion draft.
Look, Christmas comes every year.
Because Golden State, like, they just can decide everything in their war room, and then there's like we're broadcasting on ESPN at 3:30 Pacific on Friday to announce it. But they're actually picking live.
Yeah.
They're on the clock.
A two-team mock expansion draft? That's a once-in-a-lifetime thing for ESPN senior writer Kevin Felton.
Hopefully it's not.
You're saying it'll keep happening?
Hopefully it's going to happen in the NBA very soon, is what I was implying.
Wow.
But we already did a mock expansion draft. They haven't even announced expansion. We did the mock expansion draft.
There you go. It'll be more fun when it's real.
Do you want to talk Seahawks Jets next or Huskies?
No, let's talk Seahawks.
Okay. Do you have any thoughts on Aaron Rodgers' performance on Sunday?
He's so bad. My favorite part about the Aaron Rodgers performance was on the last drive of the game, which Aaron Rodgers made a throw, I think. Mark Sanchez talking about how Aaron Rodgers and Tom Downing had figured out the Seahawks defense throughout the game. And I'm like, they didn't figure out Father Time. for Aaron Rodgers. It was an incredible job of trying to create a narrative. And it was funny. I listened to Simmons and Cousin Sal's podcast like a month ago, and they were like, rank the quarterbacks you'd rather have right now. I can't remember what it was for one game to win. And they only had Rodgers at like 15th. And I'm like, dog, this is one of, if not the worst quarterbacks in the NFL. As they were talking.
Do you know what his QBR was on Sunday?
At zero? What, 32?
29.
It was just, it's interesting how people still treat quarterbacks, you know, legacy quarterbacks, basically. And I think the thing that's most shocking to, because I haven't watched that many Jets games, the thing that's most shocking to me about Aaron Rodgers is he's not capable of doing the things you would think he would still be capable of doing, if that makes sense. Like, as you're an aging quarterback, hitting Garrett Wilson wide open in the end zone, like overthrowing receivers, doesn't feel like something that you should lose. I understand it's everything, but the narrative that they're creating, I was just like, are we not watching the same game? This motherfucker's at 50% completion percentage and like 4 yards per attempt right now throughout that game.
He finished at 4.7.
Some credit has to be given to the Seahawks defense, and I don't think enough credit is being given to the Seahawks defense. You know, the Jets, where do they rank offensive DVOA overall? Bad.
Yeah.
Somewhere bad. The Seahawks defense made some plays in that game.
I mean,
and it was funny.
I would say that Leonard Williams made some plays in that game. Do we want to do the toast to him as NFC Defensive Player of the Week now?
Oh, back-to-back Defensive Players of the Week in the NFC for the Seahawks. Leonard Williams could have honestly gotten it the previous week. Also, obviously, Kobe Bryant had the pick six, but
this week, Leonard Williams was like, oh, okay, that's what it takes for me to get Defensive Player of the Week is a pick six? Sure. Here's 92 yards. How do you like that? Try that on for size. I forgot who had the stat that a pick six that long in multiple sacks in the same game has like happened two times in NFL history, and or it was at least Seahawks history, and both of them have been at MetLife Stadium in the past 14 months.
What was
with
the
Spoon
other one?
Against the Giants last season.
Okay, that one, yeah.
I mean, I was going to be disappointed about many things that the Seahawks had lost that game, but one of them would be losing the MetLife perfect record.
I was wondering if Leonard Williams was in the conversation for Defensive Player of the Year at all. Plus 3,500. So he's at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. He's 11th. I mean, that's not a terrible place to be. And he's really played himself into that after these last 2 weeks. So it is something.
He had 6.5 sacks through his first. I mean, sacks are not everything, especially for an interior defensive line. But 6.5 sacks through his first 19 games with the Seahawks. He has 4.5 in the last two.
Incredible. I mean, the way that we perceive that pick, it's funny, you know, like, I guess the what is the Pelton Cast golden rule? Because it applies to Leonard Williams. Whatever we were talking about that second round pick and whatever it meant, we're not talking about that anymore.
That is without question. He's up to third among interior defensive linemen in pass rush win rate at ESPN behind Zach Allen and Chris Jones. So he's playing at an extremely elite level.
I'd seen on the Discord, somebody posted, I can't remember who, posted a like big cat and then the like, or maybe it was just the cat emoji three times. And it was before they were ahead of me on the broadcast. And I was like, something is coming. And I was like, I'm assuming that because the situation was dire for the Seahawks in that moment. I was assuming it was a Leonard Williams sack. And I was like, great. Or even a fumble recovery or whatever. And then to see that play, him tip the ball to himself. And then I was, you know, I kind of knew it was coming, but I was like, run, big man, let's go. And for him to have a pick six in that moment, obviously completely changed the game. But the way that Leonard Williams moves, I was like, is this the greatest athlete on the face of the earth right now?
How big is Leonard Williams?
Because he was scooting down the field.
Did I mention that the Jets offense is 22nd in DVOA?
So, 22nd is not that bad. It is bad, but it's not like it's the worst offense in the NFL.
Correct.
I think people overrate just how bad the Jets are.
For example, it could be as bad as the team that the Seahawks lost to at home.
Oh, the fucking Giants. God, that's the one that's going to haunt us the most.
Oh, without question. Leonard Williams is 300 pounds.
I mean, he was... I played a two-hand touch football game. I'll talk about that later on Thanksgiving. The idea of moving that fast at that size. I don't weigh anywhere near 300 pounds. And there was another grown man that I was trying to chase down. It was like, it's not happening. At some point, I was like, I'm good on this attempt. So seeing Leonard Williams move at that size, it was an incredible moment. But the thing from the game overall, I mean, we don't need to talk about this that much because it was a win over the Jets. C'est la vie. But the thing that was most disturbing about it was being in the first half and seeing the darkness. Because in that moment, I mean, we see what the Seahawks playoff odds are at right now. If they lose that game to the Jets, obviously they still need to win this game against the Cardinals. Their playoff odds still would have improved significantly either way that you flip that. But if they'd have lost their season, more or less, their playoff odds, with losses to the Giants at home and the Jets on the road, it would have been so devastating as a Seahawks fan. And I think it was one of those things that after the game, it wasn't joy necessarily. It was just a sigh of relief.
See, because of the fact that I didn't actually go through the emotions of watching this game, I think I felt more joy in it.
I mean, I was happy about it, but it was like, I don't know. I've had a bit of a hard time watching the Seahawks. Like the Huskies, I've been very dialed in from the first play. Every game. It's just like, I'm emotionally invested. For the Seahawks, I'm like, maybe it's having expectations or something where I'm like, I think we are going to win this game. I'm not going to freak out right away. It's 10 a.m. It's Sunday morning. It's sunny outside. And then the like heart rate meter going up, because I was neutral. I was fine for it starting. And then bad thing after bad thing kept happening. And it was kind of like, what the fuck is going on right now? Like, how can this all be happening at once? So maybe it was because it was cold. Maybe it was the time of day, you know, playing a game at 10 a.m. I think it was probably just randomness.
Yes.
You know, my rule.
First, rule out randomness. And we failed to rule out randomness on this one.
I mean, the amount of fumbles that happened in the game, probably still randomness, but there were a lot of fumbles early on in that game.
I mean, I guess Seahawks concluded, you know, it wasn't entirely random based on their decision to waive LaVisca Chenault.
I mean, yeah, I don't know. Randomness can also affect people, you know? Like, LaVisca Chenault's inability to catch a kickoff, it probably was. Like, I don't think, honestly, long-term, I think LaVisca Chenault probably will be fine returning kickoffs and catching kickoffs if he gets another job. But at the same time, the position, the number one thing you can do as a kick returner is not fumble the ball, basically. Like, the good stuff is nice, but he's had quite a few turnovers this year, and those plays are just so devastating because it's not the same as an interception in a lot of situations. You're setting up the defense or the offense, the opposing offense, in such a good position for the most part when you fumble those kicks that, you know, it led to one more or less immediate touchdown. What could have been another immediate, I think the one that led to the touchdown is D Williams, right? But, you know, LaVisca Chenault just not returning those, you know, the kick that the Jets had for a touchdown. I don't think there's an endemic of bad special teams for the Seahawks. Shit happens sometimes. But fortunately, they overcame the shit happening. And I think that's where people are kind of underestimating it being a good win, is sometimes if everything goes wrong for you, you just lose the game. And in this one, the Seahawks, and especially their defense, was good enough to overcome that. And I think takeaways, people underrate, like, yes, I guess the Jets' yards per play was pretty close overall. All of the turnovers that happened from the Seahawks were on special teams, if I'm remembering correctly. And the Seahawks defense forced two pretty massive turnovers. So you kind of have to give the Seahawks defense credit for that. And overall, in just run of play scores, they gave up 7 points throughout the entire game. They held the Jets on the most crucial drive of the game. Leonard Williams came up with a big sack. You know, and even those 7 points that they scored, there was a Leonard Williams also face mask that kept the Jets on the field. And they wouldn't have been on the field if it weren't for that play. And it wasn't like an egregious face mask or anything. It didn't need to happen. So you're probably completely unaware that that even happened.
I am vaguely aware that it happened.
So that was the first touchdown that the Jets scored.
Feel it the same way.
Offensively, it's funny, like statistically, I think Football Outsiders, whatever, DVOA is not really like the Seahawks offense overall. And
it reads the Seahawks last from week 8 to week 13.
It's funny because I actually feel like that doesn't mesh with usually when your team is playing badly, you're aware that your team is playing badly, if that makes sense. Like if it's the worst offense for these last 5 weeks, usually you're feeling that as a fan. Do you agree with that?
I mean, I don't know that I would say that we're not feeling it. It's what is interesting to me is it feels like what the Seahawks have been worst at is plays that are higher leverage but less repeatable. You know, the goal line stuff, the turnovers from Geno Smith in this stretch. But if you look at it, their EPA per play, which would fully factor in all of those things in a different way than DVOA, is, I mean, it's not good, but it's 28th over that span. And they're 24th in success rate, which I think sort of speaks to like, that's how it's felt in terms of like, yeah, they're not playing well, but they're not playing horrendously.
It was more just the feeling of in the second half when they got the ball, I kind of felt like they were going to move the ball every time.
I mean, and they did generally move the ball every time in the second half, didn't they?
Where does the Jets defense rank in DVOA?
I think it's also around 22nd.
Around 22nd.
So it's not very good, although some of the other defenses they've faced, Arizona, San Francisco, much better. I think Buffalo as well.
That was, I mean, yeah, obviously that Buffalo game is fucking brutal, but, and maybe, you know, maybe that beat is weighing them down pretty significantly also. But it wasn't, there are some situations when you watch an offense that you're cheering for and you're just like, they've got no shot. There were times during Pete Carroll, Russell Wilson era, where it's just like, it's just not happening. You can feel it. And that is the way I feel about the Seahawks running the ball generally. It is the amount of negative plays. I like sometimes what Ken Walker does. The negative plays are really hard to overcome for Ken Walker. If you told me next season Ken Walker wasn't on this roster, and I don't know if Zach Charbonnet is the answer also, but a different running back, no matter where they were drafted, a different running back was the starter, I would be fine with that.
Well, let's hope not say no matter where they were drafted, because you can draft running backs really high, as it turns out.
I mean, honestly, you give me Aston Jeanty. But
I mean, here were their drives in the second half on Sunday. 12 plays, 64 yards. That was the fourth and one stop. 10 plays, 34 yards, field goal. 9 plays, 71 yards, touchdown. And then they did have one play, one drive where they completely failed to move the ball.
Took
one
knee.
Play, one minus yeah. one.
So, I mean, honestly, it's not a lot of drives, but every time they had the ball in those situations, I was like, okay, they're going to move the ball here. And that's with a mostly complete inability to run the ball.
I mean, they also had a 10-play drive in the first half. Like, they had a lot of long drives in this one. Yeah, no, I think that's fair. I mean, Geno continues to have one of the most fascinating seasons of all time.
Unright Creighton storms past number one Kansas. I think that this isn't going to make any sense. I think the stats aren't understanding that. I think they're underrating the Seahawks offense just a bit. But the high leverage plays do matter. Those plays matter. And when the Seahawks get into fourths and ones, I think they're kind of scared right now. Like, they haven't figured it out.
I remember when Geno Smith was capable of sneaking.
I truly do not understand it. I do not understand why there was not a sneak in the playbook.
Can we talk about Jaxon Smith-Njigba?
Oh.
Last 5 games, 33 catches, 510 yards, 3 touchdowns. He's catching 79% of his targets for 12.1 yards per target. Like, I mean, obviously there's a lot of competition. Is JSN a Pro Bowler this season?
Absolutely. Absolutely is. I mean, even there's the fourth down. So the Seahawks, another incredible thing that happened was, please let Michael Dixon be injured every game. Because, and I love Michael Dixon. This is not an insult to him, but they managed to find themselves in better positions overall, fourth downs that they should have gone for. When it was fourth and one and they get a delay of game or a false start, I can't remember. And then they still went for it on the fourth and six, hit the pass to JSN for the first down. It was first off just like, praise JSN for being there all the time. Caught all 4 of his targets and just massive catches every time he comes up with the ball. Huge. DK's numbers are not as good as they were because it doesn't include some of the penalties that he drew. Like, DK also had himself a phenomenal game in this one.
It's going to be very hard for him to be a Pro Bowler in the NFC.
JSN.
I like Amon-Ra St. Brown's
chances.
Once we
get to people who are not playing, like, he'll be in there.
Yeah, that's true. CeeDee Lamb, Justin Jefferson, and probably scary Terry McLaurin's got to be ahead of him, too. I think those are probably your four.
He'll eventually make it in, though. It is interesting when you look at the targets. It's like Fant, 3 receptions, 4 targets. Tyler Lockett, 3 receptions, 3 targets. A.J. Barner, my dog, two receptions, 2 targets. Basically, every drop that they had the entire game was to DK Metcalf. Not drop. Every pass that wasn't completed. You know, there were only 9 incompletions and 5 of them were to DK. So, you know, he's drawing probably the toughest defender on the Jets. You know, Sauce Gardner was on him a lot of the time. But the goal line plays, it's interesting to see UW struggle with goal line plays. And maybe this is endemic across the league if you don't have a tush push, but they just have not figured it out.
I don't think it's endemic the degree what has been for the Seahawks.
They ran a quick pass where they were trying to get it to DK and Sauce broke it up. And it was just like, this shit just isn't going to work. You see some of the play calls and you know from the beginning, you're like, nope, that's not going to do it. Obviously, punching in the touchdown that Zach Charbonnet had at the end was very nice. Them scoring comfortably from the goal line. But I left that game feeling better about the Seahawks overall than I did and about their chances against Arizona. I know that DVOA doesn't necessarily agree with me. I think the Seahawks are a better team than the Arizona Cardinals are. And I think the statistics are, we'll see on Sunday, obviously. And even if the Seahawks win, doesn't necessarily mean that. But I think this team is a better team than the Cardinals are. And I think the defense is being, I don't know where are they at. You can't see fucking DVOA like defense. Are you subscribed to their?
I'm not, but if you do the week by week stats, you can. In fact, see it. They are now 11th in defensive DVOA.
I think they're an even better defensive team than that.
They are 6th from week 8 onwards, and that includes the Buffalo game that went very poorly.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, like if you take a situation where you kind of take the two extreme outliers and take the difference, they're probably a top 5 defense overall, and that's not the whatever 19th best team in the league.
I mean, the other thing about the being last in offensive DVOA from week 8 to week 13 is it's just like not a very bad for last. Over the first 7 weeks of the season, you have Miami at -34%. You have Cleveland at -43%. The Seahawks in that stretch are -18. So there's just not been anyone really horrible in offense during that span. That's another factor.
I mean, they have not put up even just raw points wise. The Jets was the best game that they had.
Well, they haven't had 300 yards in a lot of weeks. They haven't given up 300 yards in a lot of weeks, but they haven't had them either. So
I was thinking about, you know, we sort of have to draw things on the Pete Carroll, John Schneider scale, right? Pete Carroll still weighs heavily over this organization. And where we are in the, you know, 2008, 2009 range, and I think where we're at is we are at the second half of the Tarvarius-Jackson season, where it was kind of like the defense had it figured out. All of a sudden, like, they got it. Pete got it. He understood what this defense was. He had the personnel. They turned it on. I think they ended up, what, 8-8 that year? 7-9?
8-8 sounds right.
Maybe they were in... And...
They were 7-9.
7-9 that season.
Lost
but it was
the final game of the season in overtime at Arizona to finish 7-9.
I know there was the big Niners game on Christmas Eve, which was kind of like... That was the first game where I was like, oh, I'm back in. I was out for a while, but I'm back in. I think we're at that phase right now. And the pieces, like the defense getting it together, figuring it out, that is a huge piece. The next step is the offense. Whether that happens this year or not, I don't know. But I do think a lot of the pieces are in place for when the offense figures it out. And when you pair those two, you have a Super Bowl contending team.
Yeah.
So I think that's where we're at. The Seahawks are going to gain 300 yards. Very neutral environment. This will be the best weather situation that they play in since,
I mean,
at Atlanta when they won 34-14.
At San Francisco was pretty good weather.
Okay.
The offense wasn't great in that one.
But you do have to look at the last time that they played in a dome. I mean, was that?
Was the Atlanta game, yeah.
They put up 339 yards. Still wasn't a phenomenal game, but 6 yards per play.
At Detroit, they were pretty good offensively.
I don't want to go too far forward because we'll talk about it later, but the offense being bad kind of started happening around that time period, right?
Yes.
Like around the time period that DVOA is broken out, that they're the worst in the league. It doesn't mean these things aren't permanent in the NFL. And trends don't always continue in one direction. So people, I left that game feeling pretty good about both sides of the ball.
People pay too much attention to the direction something is headed and not enough to where it is overall, which is still not great, but not 32nd. Did you leave the Oregon game feeling good about things? Oh.
Yes, I did.
Oh, wow. Okay. Optimistic, Tristan. I mean, DeMond Williams Jr. acquitted himself acceptably for making your first career start against the number one team in the nation on the road.
Hold on. Let me pull up this box score here. DeMond has things to figure out.
I mean, obviously, it's when number one is you're allowed to throw the ball away. Like, if they just work with him on that one particular rule, that's, you know, you've got all these extra weeks of bowl practice. That's got to be the focus. You're allowed to throw the ball away.
That's definitely part of it. The Oregon's, the Huskies offensive line just isn't very good. I don't know, like, you could basically, if pinpoint the lines in this game overall, right? That's it. The Huskies' lines are not very good. Defensive line, offensive line. They played without two very important defensive linemen. They haven't had Zach Durfee for much of the season. Not having Russell Davis was a factor. And the offensive line, I mean, some of the players they were starting in this game, I had no idea who they were. And despite all of that, Jonah Coleman had 11 carries for 3 yards in this game. And what did DeMond Williams do? He was 17 for 20 against Oregon for 200 yards. It wasn't a 17 for 20 for 98. This wasn't Drew Aller out there. DeMond Williams got the ball downfield efficiently. We kind of saw, like, DeMond Williams, the sky is the limit for him overall. As a runner,
Do you still think that Noah Fifita is going to be the Huskies quarterback next year?
Oh, it's DeMond's job. Yeah, there's obviously. No doubt. It was the moment, the second half of USC, I was like, it's done. That's it.
What was the latest on the conflicting reports on whether Noah Fifita is transferring? Okay, his father says no, so.
There hasn't been anything further on it, I don't think. But you know who else is transferring?
Who's that?
Every quarterback from every school in the country. So, just keep an eye on that. Just quarterback, the position is transferring. But what DeMond did, this is as a true freshman. Dylan Gabriel has three kids and a fucking mortgage right now on the other side of the field. Like, it could not be more radically different as far as age and experience of quarterbacks. This was not even just, DeMond Williams is young. He also hasn't started his entire freshman year, 17 for 20 against Oregon. I'm sorry, but that was a phenomenal stat line. And he made a bunch of plays that there wasn't a chance in hell Will Rogers was going to make. The line wasn't there. When you're pressured that quickly, like, he needs to get better pocket awareness and situational awareness. It's obvious that that has to happen. That is something that takes time and experience. And
Dylan Gabriel's first road start, he was pretty awesome as a freshman. His first road start was at Florida Atlantic. He was 7 of 19. But for 245 yards and two touchdowns and ran for a touchdown. Kind of a wild stat line.
That was in 2006. how old is Dylan Gabriel actually?
This is his fifth year.
His sixth
year, I should say.
Sixth year as a quarterback. The amount of time he has had to DeMond Williams, which honestly, Dylan Gabriel wasn't the reason the Huskies lost this game.
I mean, Dylan Gabriel could have been the reason the Huskies lost this game if he had needed to be.
He was good. He was fine. But it's just the way that their line dominated the Huskies' line on both sides of the ball. And that was one of the differences. A lot of offensive linemen transferred. when Kalen DeBoer left for Alabama.
And if you're looking at where the season would have been different had Kalen DeBoer stayed, besides for the fact that DeMond Williams Jr. would not have been starting, it would have been Austin Mack. The offensive line is the spot where it actually made a difference to the 2024 Huskies.
Yeah. I mean, you could look at the dominoes of it's the Russell Wilson trade, where it's like we're happy about Jamal Adams because it led to the Russell Wilson trade, which maybe we're now upset about, but somehow led to Devin Witherspoon and Jackson Smith and Jigba. At some point, like, everything that happened led to two of the most exciting young players in the NFL being on the Seahawks.
And we're just enjoying the Russessence.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm so excited about it. But this game, I love the Adam Muhammad, that Jonah Coleman was 11 for 3 and Adam Muhammad with the 4 for 23 behind him.
The DeMond Williams, 22 carries for 17 yards. It's just wild stat line.
He was so sacked.
10 for minus 49 on sacks, 12 for 66 actually running.
That is obviously you can't take out the sacks because they're part. Look, DeMond Williams is probably going to be sacked a lot as a quarterback overall. It's one of those things that you kind of live with. If this is the NFL and you don't include sacks in it, you look at that box score and you're like, who is this? Who did this against Oregon, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was an encouraging game. I think in addition to pocket awareness, it's also just like for most of his life, he's been able to run away from anyone. You know, he's been able to Bo Jackson and Tecmo Bowl against anyone. And now he can't do that. And so that he's got to adapt to a little bit. And I mean, I think that's one of those things where like playing game reps does matter relative to practice, because you're not facing a live pass rush in practice. It's not the same situation. The other thing I'd say, he got sacked a lot. They mostly weren't long sacks. Like, it was a lot of like 2 and 3 yard sacks.
Because they're more like scrambling sacks than right. They are. But the pressure came.
Which are not that different from an incompletion. Like, the EPA loss was actually not that bad on many of those, which is why his QBR ended up as good as it did, a 74. Like, he's not going to lead the Big Ten in QBR, sadly.
But here's a
74 QBR is better than the majority of Will Rogers starts this season.
He's not going to lead the Big Ten in QBR this year, because DeMond Williams is going to be a QBR god.
Well, we'll see. Yeah, he definitely does have that potential.
Okay, let me throw you another number out there. How many times do you think Oregon gave up 21 points or more on the season?
Three?
Three times. And do you know who those opponents were?
Boise State.
Yep.
Ohio State.
Uh-huh.
Washington.
And the University of Washington. Two teams that are in the college football playoff and DeMond fucking Williams. So don't tell me that I am down about this game. We weren't supposed to win it.
There you go. Right? I mean, well, I think what it told us is what the advanced stats told us all year, that the UW offense was underrated, especially with DeMond at the controls, and the UW defense was somewhat overrated by their ability to come up with a lot of goal line stands and things like that. It was a lot of bend but don't break from the UW defense is often the want for a Belichick defense. And it turns out when you go against a team like Oregon, you just break.
The defense also has been pretty broken down by injuries. You know, like, it just wasn't, this wasn't the full UW defense. And
I'm not necessarily down on it long term. I just think in the context of this year's team that people kind of didn't understand because they looked at points for and against, and it wasn't quite reflective because of opponent quality and because of, you know, kind of unsustainable factors, how good the offense and defense were.
So let me put this in perspective for you. Boise State, possible Heisman Trophy winner, very experienced team overall, right? Go on the road in Oregon, 21 points, going to the college football playoff, almost certainly, right? Obviously, they need to win this weekend, but good chance of making the college football playoff. Ohio State, lock for the college football playoff, scored the same amount of points. Or no, did they score more? I think they scored the same amount of points as UW scored at Oregon. And that was Will Howard at quarterback, right? Almost the same amount of experience as somebody like Dylan Gabriel. DeMond Williams, as a true freshman, went into Oregon and put up those kind of numbers, because nobody else gets credit for this on the offense. Like, yes, the receivers made good plays overall, but sorry, no offense to Jonah Coleman. Nobody gets credit. This is a DeMond Williams offense. This next year is a DeMond Williams season. It is on him. And if he performs, if he improves, improvement is not necessarily linear. We think improvement is linear. It is not. But if Damon Williams improves 10%, 15%, something like that, if he's better next year than he is this year, the sky is literally the limit. Like, Damon Williams could be a Heisman Trophy winner. That is within the realm of possibilities for Damon. The Husky offense, they didn't spend the entire offseason setting up an offense around Damon. And they're going to have an entire offseason to set up an offense around Damon. It's his team. That's it, period. It is his team. He and Jonah Coleman together next year is going to be, assuming everybody stays, I'm going to knock on wood. I think there are a lot of teams that would be happy to have Damon Williams. I hope that the Huskies open up the bank and make sure that he is here and happy. But any money that you would spend on a quarterback from the transfer portal, it's going to Damon. So want to make sure that he is back, obviously feeling good. He's been with Jed. Seems like he's very committed to him. The two of them this offseason are going to get in the lab, and they are going to figure out this Damon offense, and it's going to be impressive because there are a lot of quarterbacks who run like Damon Williams runs. There are not a lot of quarterbacks who could throw who could have a completion percentage of 17 for 20 at Oregon in their first ever start. You see Anthony Richardson. Anthony Richardson, obviously bigger, different body frame than something like Damon. Nowhere near as accurate as a passer as he is as a true freshman.
That is one thing about Damon Williams. I would prefer not to see him run as much just from a frame standpoint.
He does not need to be a running – like, he was not a running – I went and read his 247 Sports profile today, and they were like, he's a pure pocket passer.
Really?
he was not considered – he was a great, phenomenal athlete, but the way that he played in high school wasn't necessarily as a runner. But if you had 10 players from Oregon coming after you in 1 second, you'd be a runner too if you were that fast. Yeah. So – I think the way that you design it is like, when Lamar was at Louisville, he wasn't necessarily a running quarterback, right? Or even the way that you look at the Baltimore offense, you don't see the Baltimore offense and say like, this is designed around Lamar running necessarily. It's
He's a dual threat. I do not think I agree with this. Do you know how many carries that, that Lamar Jackson had at Louisville in his career? He played three years at Louisville. How many carries do you think he had?
This includes sacks, too.
Okay, fine. 655.
Oh,
shit. He ran for 1,600 yards. He led the nation in rushing as a junior. Lamar was pretty fucking good. He led the nation in both passing and rushing yards. Or maybe that's conference. I guess that's conference. Not the nation. He did win the Heisman as a sophomore. He finished third that season. Okay.
He won that. But what was his completion percentage? It was never that good, right?
He topped it 59%. Is it
59%. I'm telling you, there are a lot of quarterbacks.
I'm excited. Like
I need to knock on wood. Damon Williams is kind of a unicorn right now. If he was 2 to 3 inches taller, people would be perceiving him as probably like the number one player in the country, like a possible future first pick of the draft. If he was a little bit bigger. I mean, again, Anthony Richardson was the fourth pick, right? Was he third? No, he is fourth, right? Right before Devin Witherspoon. And I think apples to apples, Damon Williams is a better player than him overall. So that completion percentage, again, he didn't throw the ball away. Part of it is that he didn't throw the ball away. Would have been some more completions. He has stuff to learn, but the accuracy is there. And there are not that many quarterbacks who can run as well as he can run. And who could, I mean, honestly, like somebody like Bo Nix is, you know, not super far off where he is a very good runner when he needed to be, but an extraordinarily accurate passer. And if you could set up an offense for him where he can make the easy throws and then run when he needs to, that's a freaking offense right there. So I'm hyped about UW football right now. I did not leave that game. You know, it's frustrating. I'm not happy about losing to Oregon, but we got a glimpse of the future.
All right, now we're into this podcast. Should we actually start the usual rundown? I don't know that we're going to have time for Coach's Corner this week.
You're cutting it? It's like 2 seconds.
Okay, well, we'll keep it quick.
Are we doing? We have to do toast, don't we?
We do. Okay. We'll start with UW running back Jonah Coleman, who announced that he'll be returning for his senior season in 2025. That was a very early announcement from Jonah Coleman. He didn't wait for the team banquet, Michael Penix Jr. style. Congrats to Mike McDonald and his wife Stephanie on the birth of their first child, Jack. Amazing that Mike McDonald's been on this defensive run. Mike Sean Dugar, Third Pelton brother, had a story about him being in his bag in terms of play calling, while also like preparing to have a child. So congrats to the both of them. Congrats to Mike Holmgren, a finalist for the Pro Football Hall of Fame class of 2025. So another step closer to the Hall of Fame. Congrats to UW men's basketball. You can never take this away from 2024-25 UW men's basketball. Champions of the Acrisure Invitational.
Hang the banner.
Husky's so good on conference tournaments and so very bad in conference tournaments. I don't get it. Congrats to Sounders defender Yaimar Gomez Andrade, who was selected for the MLS Best 11. A bit amusing since his fellow center back Jackson Reagan was a finalist for the Defender of the Year over Gomez Andrade, but I think well-deserved. Gomez Andrade previously made Best 11 in 2021. He joins Chad Marshall and Raul Ruiz Diaz as the Sounders who have done so twice per Sounder at heart. We're also this week saying farewell officially to Ruiz Diaz. The Sounders wished him farewell on social media as they made their end of season decisions, although we obviously knew that was going to happen for a long period of time here. All right, Coach's Corner.
Okay, I'll be brief. We had the first practice. I won't talk about my Thanksgiving Turkey Bowl game, but I will say it was a fine performance. I went 1-for-1 passing on a lateral. Lateral back to me, and I threw up a bomb to like an 8-year-old that he caught 30 yards downfield. I was shocked that he got it, but that was a great one, and came up with a massive pick in the game that after that I possessed no lung capacity after that. it was I had this pick. I was like, I'm gonna try to return it. Nope, I got tackled right away, and that was it for the rest of the game. Wow. We also suffered only one catastrophic injury from a 50-year-old who was playing in the game.
Oh, no.
Which definitely slowed me down. It was a non-contact injury, and it was one of those moments where I was like, you see a non-contact injury for somebody who's 50, and you're kind of like, yeah, that's not good. That was to the calf, and he's like, I need to be going home right this second.
But not the Achilles?
And was pretty panicked. No, it was a calf injury.
You remember when our uncle suffered an Achilles rupture playing pickup basketball with us?
Yes, I do. I chose not to bring that up in the moment. But yeah. As we all know, the non-contact injuries are the ones that are the scariest. So
when he immediately said, "You kicked me," and I was like, "No, I didn't."
Yeah.
Now you know.
Anyway, that was fun. Only led to Mateo fighting at the very, very end of the game.
Good.
But week one of basketball practice was this week where the Celtics, I think I might have mentioned that before.
Oh, wow. The defending champs.
Oh, yeah.
Are you going to plan to shoot as many threes as Joe Mazzulla?
Well, they do not have threes in the league, so probably not.
0% three-point rate.
So it's almost exactly the same team as I had. It was basically the exact same team as the flag football team.
Your
right?
Dogs.
My dogs. There are a few slight changes, but as you know, these kids are insane. And so I first practice, I have my whistle. I'm like, all right, I've been thinking about this all week. And I'm like, I need to shut everything down right away. Football is kind of a contained thing. It's once a week. You do a practice, you do a game. It's a little bit more, you can have tantrums in football a little bit unseen, if that makes sense. Like you could just take somebody out of the game pretty quickly for a play and put somebody else in. Basketball, hypothetically, half the kids are playing one quarter, half the kids are playing the next quarter. You know, if somebody is having a tantrum on the court, I need to walk onto the court and pull them off of the court. It's not like football where you could just get to the sideline really easily. So I went in the first game or the first practice and I was like, here is how the season is going to look. We are going to show up. We are going to kick people's asses and we are going to go the fuck home. Our goal this season is perfection. We are not going to complain. We are not going to fight. We are not going to talk when our teammates score a point and everybody else and you don't. We are not going to say anything like that. We are going to support our teammates. We're going to do everything in our ability to not give up a point at all. And we are going to be quiet about it. and then we're going to go home. I'm like, we are going to be Tim Duncan Spurs this season. I'm like, if I see one of you fighting or complaining, I will call a timeout and I will take you out of this game. I was like, we obviously possess the ability to do this right now. And you know what? In that first practice, not a single fight. There was one complaint. I separated them into sides for a scrimmage. And one kid was like, oh, I'm on the crappy team. And I was like, that is not happening. We are not doing that. First off, you're all on the same team. We are all one unit together. But I was like, that is not happening. We are weeding that out from this team. We are going to be smug about these championships that we're going to win. So I'm going in there straight up. This is Pop style. Like, we're accepting nothing from this team anymore, behavior wise. I will keep you updated on how these goals go.
Yeah, good luck with that. All right, roundup time.
You've been waiting for this.
The Kraken lost 3 in a row, all by multiple goals, to the Pacific's two worst teams, the two teams below them in the standings, before starting a 4-game road trip with an impressive 4-2 win Tuesday at Carolina. Winger Andrei Burakovsky and wingers Andrei Burakovsky and Daniel Sprong were healthy scratches in this one. I would be hesitant to draw a causation there to that correlation, but we'll see what kind of dividends that yields going forward. This trip takes the Kraken into the tri-state area this weekend as they play all three New York City metro area teams in a 4-day span before returning home. Seattle Sounders, also Saturday, just after the UW football game, saw their season come to an end with a 1-0 loss in the Western Conference Finals to the LA Galaxy. Neither team was able to create much offense most of this game. There were 5 shots on goal apiece. Neither finished with a full XG, with the Galaxy at 0.7, 0.6 for the Sounders. But the Galaxy capitalized on a Sounders giveaway in their own half with clinical transition, where Riki Pooch, who was playing with a torn ACL, we learned after this match, played in Dejan Jovalic for a running strike in the 85th minute to win it for the Galaxy and end the Sounders' playoff run. Bright spot in this one, I would say, would be the strong start for 22-year-old Georgi Manungu at left wing in place of the injured Paul Rothrock and Reed Baker-Whiting, someone I think that we could see in a bigger role next season. Brian Schmetzer said afterwards that, quote, this season has not been a success because we didn't win any trophies, which is the high bar the Sounders set. They reached the semifinals of both the MLS Cup and the U.S. Open Cup, as well as the quarterfinals of the League's Cup. Ended up losing all of them to teams from L.A.
That's like me with my dogs. You know, this season will not be a success if we don't win any trophies.
Oh, wow. You and Brian Schmetz are very similar.
Schmetz!
You don't dress as nicely on the sidelines.
Did you watch any of... I have a City of Renton mandated shirt.
zero.
Which I don't wear.
I saw zero of this game. As I was in LA, the LA area, for this weekend, but was out to dinner. So was just following along with the Discord commentary when I could.
Well, neither did I, thanks to the MLS. I don't know if after that Husky game, I was kind of like, I like how I'm like framing it as if I was happy, like not unhappy right after the Husky game. I was riding high on cloud Damon Williams. that's more of a like the next day you look back sort of thing. Feel good
right,
about.
Right. Yeah. And you might also have not have been as optimistic had the Seahawks not beat the Jets. So looking ahead, in addition to Rui Diaz, veterans Joao Paulo and Albert Rusnak also out of contract. Rusnak has been in negotiations with the team before pausing for the playoffs and told reporters, quote, the ideas are very similar, if not identical. So especially after his best season with the Sounders, very much expect him back. Joao Paulo also still in negotiations, according to the team, although he could move on after being surpassed on the depth chart by Oba and Vargas. But Vargas transfer rumors won't die down, particularly after his decision to represent Mexico internationally instead of the USA. Schmetzer said on postgame Saturday, quote, let's see how long we can keep him on the roster. Sounders made a couple of other roster decisions on Wednesday. They declined their team options on backup center back Nathan, as well as UW product Dylan Tevez and homegrown product Soto Kitahara. So all of them will become free agents. A little bit of Seattle Reign news. They've signed free agent defender Madison Curry, who had started 20 matches for Angel City FC as a rookie, to a three-year contract. So this looks like a very nice pickup for the Reign as they start the NWSL offseason in earnest. All right, UW basketball. The women, in completing their tournament in the Bahamas last Wednesday, got 18 points and 6 assists from Hannah Steins, leading 4 starters in double figures versus Southern, while their other starter, Tyra Akai, had 8 points, 11 boards, and 4 blocks in a 61-43 win. They limited the winless Jaguars to 23% shooting. Now, next up for the Huskies, the number one team in the nation comes to Heck Yeah.
Bring it on. Bring it on.
The UCLA Bruins entered the season ranked number 5, have started 8-0, highlighted by a 77-62 home win over number 1 South Carolina that vaulted the Bruins into the top spot in the rankings. They also beat another ranked opponent, number 17 Louisville, by 7 in their opener in Paris. They played the first 3 games, including that Louisville game, without star junior Kiki Rice, who's working her way back to 100%, had a season-high 21 points last Sunday versus Hawaii. The Bruins, led by junior center Lauren Betts, who's averaging a double-double of 19.1 points, 10.9 rebounds, and 2.1 blocks per game. They've also got junior Gabriela Jaquez, the younger sister of Jaime, a strong role player. And then freshman point guard Alina Arnasalo has averaged a team-high 6.3 assists per game. And she's just starting because they were still waiting for the return of former WSU point guard Charlize Laguerre-Walker from a January ACL tear.
What day is that game again?
That is Sunday afternoon at 2 p.m.
Okay. I was thinking I'd be at a Seahawks game. No, next week.
It will not be at a Seahawks game, but it is directly opposite. No, it is on Big Ten Plus.
Okay. Damn. All right.
So tough timing, unfortunately, for what is, probably the biggest game of the year for women's basketball.
Exactly opposite the Seahawks.
I guess, no, it's actually not the biggest game of the year. The biggest game of the year is opposite the NBA All-Star game. They're hosting USC and Juju Watkins, which I am very bummed about that particular timing.
As long as the important games are opposite something else.
Exactly. That's what you're going to want.
That's wait, hold on. I'm pulling up tickets to that game. It's opposite the WNBA All-Star game in February?
No, the NBA All-Star game.
Oh, the NBA All-Star. I don't know. I said WNBA.
This is not as big of an obstacle for most people as it is for me.
Do you think the tickets are going to be obscenely expensive for that one already?
I don't know. I don't know if people have planned that far ahead for it.
That's why I have to buy the tickets before the podcast airs.
Literally ones of the listener will be going out and checking that one out.
That's the demand will go way up.
February 16th at 4 p.m. Huskies versus USC, who's 7-1. So far this season.
February 16th. I mean, I want to go.
Yeah. All right, UW men's basketball, the Acrisure Invitational Champions.
Hello.
They beat Colorado State 73-67 on Thursday with Tyler Harris as the star, scoring 24 points on 9 of 13 shooting with 5 threes and 8 rebounds. They shot 1 of 7 on Friday. But the Huskies got 2 strong games from tournament MVP Great Osabor, who totaled 35 points, 16 rebounds, 12 assists, and 6 steals. And Zoom Diallo had 15 points on 5 of 9 shooting versus Santa Clara on Friday as the Huskies got the 76-69 win. They held both opponents below 50% on twos, having allowed just one opponent to that point all season to beat that mark, that being, of course, UMass Lowell. So the Huskies undefeated all time at the home of the Coachella Valley Firebirds. Tuesday, they played their first ever Big Ten game against UCLA at Pauley Pavilion. They were within 45-43 midway through the second half before UCLA went on an 11-0 run, shot 3 of 16 from 3, and it had 8 turnovers from Osabor as they lost that one 69-58. It was another double-double for Tyler Harris with 12 points, 11 boards. The big takeaway so far, UW's defense, good enough to compete in any game. The offense, very, very up and down at best.
I'd rather look for Husky women's basketball tickets than talk about the Husky men's basketball team.
Did you watch this UCLA game? You did.
I watched every second of it.
Oh, there you go.
And I hated all of it. No. I think that
I'd say it felt different from a Pac-12 game in that there were a lot fewer whistles for most of it. Like, they were letting a lot of contact go.
Yes.
The Big Ten officiating will legit be different in that regard. What else did you hate about it? The lack of outside shooting?
Every other aspect. Sorry, I'm busy buying women's basketball tickets here. Anyway, this is my favorite part of the podcast when I'm buying tickets to something. We've done this like kind of a lot. I'm like booking dinner reservations and buying tickets.
I guess we didn't mention, by the way, the storm schedule is out. I had forgotten that happened this week because so much other stuff happened. I don't know if you can get, yeah, I mean, individual tickets are obviously not on sale, but the Indiana Fever are headed to town on Tuesday, June 24th. They have again managed to put it opposite the NBA draft such that I will probably be out of town. And then again on Sunday, August 3rd, which is opposite Seafair.
So are the UW women, a bunch of the sections are GA?
Yes.
How long has that been the case?
I think probably pretty close to forever.
Okay, sounds good. I mean, there are, appears, GA tickets available.
Yeah, I'm sure there are. Storm start their season May 17th at Phoenix. Their home opener also against the Mercury on Friday, May 23rd. They welcome the Aces in Jewel Loy's return on your birthday, Sunday, May 25th, if you want to get tickets for that one for your birthday. You didn't enjoy that joke? You're too busy buying tickets to even notice it.
I literally am buying tickets to this game right now.
The Liberty come to town on defending champion Liberty come to town June 22nd. And again on Friday, September 5th, the penultimate game for the regular season. The Storm close out the regular season on Tuesday, September 9th, hosting the Golden State Valkyries.
Is there anything? Oh, it's a Sunday is the All-Star game.
That is what day the Sunday the All-Star game traditionally is held.
So this is not Super Bowl Sunday, just making sure. Because that would be, okay, it's the week after the Super Bowl.
Correct.
Right?
All right, so we're turning to UW men's basketball.
Should I take all of my children to this game? I feel like they're going to want to go. It's like, Anyway, the thing that I didn't like about it was not so great Osabor. And I really am, I'm sorry if you don't like that. You're not approving of this. Are you taking that out?
I don't think I'm taking it out. I'm just registering my disapproval.
I'm sorry, but he's the focal point of the offense, and I don't know if this has been the case forever in his career, but being that size with the way that he plays, having a field goal percentage as bad as Great Osabor's is right now is kind of shocking. Both the turnovers and how bad the finishing is. There was one ball that he threw down and dunked, and I was like, can we just do this? Right? I understand it's hard. He's a little bit undersized, but I'm starting to see that possibly what Great Osabor did in the Mountain West is not something that is going to be replicable in the Big Ten. Obviously, some of the height that UCLA had, what's his name? The third tallest player in the country. Like
Ade Mara.
Which, I mean, he had that run, and it was kind of the first stretch that UCLA pulled ahead during. But the finishing is just not there. And seeing how bad the finishing is compared to some of the big men we've had in UW history, right? Like, is he that much smaller than John Brockman?
No, he's bigger than John Brockman.
Bigger than John Brockman. Like, I would take Matthew Bryan Amening. I'm talking about, like, basically every UW big that I've really liked. Not necessarily the centers, but of those power forwards that UW has had, sort of same physique as Great Osabor, all of them are better finishers. And it's shocking. Again, has his field goal percentage been this bad previously?
No, he shot 59% last season.
What is going on?
And, like, I mean, I know, you know, you said, you know, playing against lesser competition, but, like, Utah, I mean, the Mountain West is a good conference.
Well, and also, this is happening in games not against UCLA. That, I think, is the more concerning thing.
Utah, like, State's strength of schedule last year ranked 88th in the country. UW so far this season ranks 104th. Oh, no, I guess 66th. It is a little better than that.
But basically, if you give me half of those buckets, that most of them are layups, it really is just, and maybe this is luck. At this point, I'm willing to say, but I feel like we're kind of building enough of history to see that things aren't changing. And, like, he's going to have good games, but...
And he's doing a lot as a playmaker and with his steals and as a rebounder. Like, he's filling out the box score. But yes, the offense has not been what you hoped for.
And that's what UW, like, they need all the things, right? But if you're going to be a player like that, if you're going to be the centerpiece of the team, right? Because he's functionally should be the best player on the team. And maybe he still is, but you need to be able to score in a way. And that's the difference between UW having any sniff at the NCAA tournament or being 15th in the Big Ten. And right now they feel like they're closer to that. I thought the defense overall, I couldn't tell whether it was just UCLA not being able to hit shots, but I thought Danny Sprinkle went into this game with a pretty good game plan overall. UCLA hit a couple of clutch shots. UW didn't in a few moments. There was one three that I don't know, God, who was it? Had in like the, they were down three and somebody had a wide open three that he didn't take. And
Tyler Harris.
It was Tyler Harris. And I'm just like, what are you doing? How do you not? And I think Casey Jacobson was mad about this also. But it was like, just fire that ball right there in that moment. They can't be tentative about it. So I loved seeing Wilhelm Breidenbach, and I think Zoom Diallo made some really nice plays, but like there are pieces there, but without great playing at a pretty high level, which he's just not offensively. Like, you can't tell me he's not.
Oh yeah, he's not playing at a high. No, he's definitely not playing at a high level offensively.
It is really difficult. It is extraordinarily difficult even to watch. So it was a frustrating game. I got excited in the second half for a moment, but like, just the finishing is so difficult.
Well, we will see. First off, just to note, Frank Kepnong still hasn't played since the Nevada game. It's looking increasingly unclear whether he's going to be able to contribute at all. Just this knee injury continues to be an ongoing thing, unfortunately. You know, we're almost 2 years removed from his ACL tear, which came in the stretch of Pac-12 games that came during non-conference play in December 22. So it's been a while. Huskies wrap up this little Big Ten stretch on Sunday in a game you will be attending, hosting. Wait, aren't you going to that?
I'm
going is Saturday, I should
Maryland
say.
Maryland game on January 2nd.
Oh, I thought you said you were going to this.
Oh, I thought this was the first. Is this a home game?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
This is the first Big Ten home game. It's Saturday.
Against USC?
USC.
I'm going to the first real Big Ten home game against classic Big Ten foe Maryland.
Oh, when you think of Maryland, of the Big Ten, you can't help but think of Maryland.
Over under on me saying the name Juan Dixon. 9.5.
What about Lonnie Baxter?
2.5.
Okay.
Steve Franchise, though.
Steve Blake?
99.5. Oh, Steve Blake. those Terps teams, I was just like, we've got to get into the Big Ten, and so do they someday, so we can face the Terps.
USC off to a slower start under their new head coach, Eric Musselman. They are 5-4 after losing their Big Ten opener at home to Oregon on Wednesday night. They have yet to beat any opponent ranked in the top 180 on KenPom. Went 5-0 against mid-majors, but lost at home to Cal in what's now a non-conference matchup, because that's a thing, and got blasted 71-36 by St. Mary's playing in Palm Valley in a separate tournament from the Huskies, then lost the third place game of that tournament 83-73 to New Mexico. They have basically an entirely new roster this year. UMass transfer Josh Cohen's their leading scorer, three other transfer starters in double figures. I'm a believer in former Xavier guard Desmond Claude, but he hasn't taken the anticipated step forward. Former Husky Wesley Yates had 24 points against Cal and San Jose State combined, but had just 3 in the previous 3 games entering the Oregon game as his minutes had dwindled, then played 10 minutes against Oregon and scored 1 point. So continues not to be a real big factor for this one for them. This is a very winnable game for UW and the kind of game that they need to win if they're going to be at all competitive in the Big Ten.
The shooting's just so bad. Just looking at these stats, 19 of 49, 3 for 16 from, ugh. And there was a stretch in the first half where I was like, they have no idea what to do. Like, did you watch the game?
I had it on the second screen, but I was busy following the NBA Cup.
There was a stretch for probably 5 minutes where I was like, they've got no clue. They have no answers. They have no clue at all. And they ended up getting it back together, which I was kind of surprised by, but it would be fun to watch a team that could play offense. It's been a while.
Last year's team actually was pretty good offensively, weren't they?
I guess, how about this? It would be fun to watch a team that could shoot.
I agree with that, yes. They were 38th in adjusted offensive efficiency last year. But 94th in three-point percentage, which qualifies as pretty good when you consider... So, since... That was the only time that the Huskies have ranked in the top 100 in the nation in 3-point percentage since 2011. Was last season.
They're generations. I had
How is that
zero
possible?
children, zero out of 15 children.
And if you take away last season, the last 4 years, the Huskies' 3-point percentage, 288th, 319th, and now this year, 294th.
Are there that many schools?
Oh, there's more schools all the time. I have to keep adding them. It's
Oh,
very
God.
annoying.
Can we just stop?
We can't.
Luka was like 10 teams from Texas are bowl eligible. And I was like, there aren't 10 teams from Texas. He was like, this one will be easy for you. And I'm like, it was, God, who was it? Not, it wasn't Stephen F. Austin. Sam Houston State.
Oh, the
They're bowl
Bearcats.
eligible. Yeah, the Bearcats with a K. He was like, this is one that's, he was like, their name is Bearcats, but it's with a K. And I'm just like, that doesn't narrow it
I
down.
mean, it does narrow it down, just not for you. As we enter the recruiting section of this pod, the Huskies got a commitment from four-star forward Nico Bundalo, who's ranked number 25 in the ESPN Top 100. He's playing in California at Prolific Prep, 6'10" lefty. I believe he grew up in Ohio, but I don't have that written down anymore. But the important questions here, the Pelton cast is asking the important questions. Is Nico Bundalo Italian?
Hello.
And the answer is no. His parents are Serbian refugees. Because
Okay.
it's Niko and not Nico, which would be the
Got it.
Italian spelling.
We'll still cheer for him.
But a 6'10" lefty, so excited to have him on board the Huskies now. Two top 50 recruits for next season in Danny Sprinkle's first recruiting
He's
class.
kind of doing the thing. Do you feel like their NIL commitment is greater in basketball than it has been in football overall?
No, I wouldn't necessarily say that. I think they just like used a large chunk of it on Grado Sabor. I mean, I think we talked about this last year when the job opened, that I want to say it was Matt Norlander was asked, or reposted someone who was asked, like, which team that does better in NIL than you would expect, and that person who was plugged in mentioned UW. Keon Brooks
For
Jr. was also making a lot
basketball,
for basketball
or
specifically.
so then, yes, is the answer to my question.
No, because I still think UW football is doing better relatively.
I mean, but we're talking relative to the competition.
That's
Like,
what I'm
yes,
saying. I
they're
don't think the
spending.
UW men's basketball is in the top 25 nationally in spending. I do think UW football is.
Okay, well, speaking of UW football and spending.
All right, well, let's touch on a couple other things. Likely bowl options for the Huskies appear to be the LA Bowl or the Sun Bowl, swinging in large part on whether Arizona State wins the Big 12 title game and
Is
reaches
that
the college football
incredible?
playoff. Because that's the thing we all expected. Definitely the team heading to the Big 12 from the Pac-12 that we were like, oh yeah, that team's got a chance to play in the title game next season. Arizona State.
No, it's so funny. Thinking about, I was like, oh yeah, a team from Arizona is possibly going to be headed to the college football playoff, and it is Arizona State. Life comes at you fast, which is an important thing to remember in college football, and a thing that most people do not remember in college football.
And a thing to remember, good thing to remember in life.
But I'll also tap into the call to the Pelton Cast golden rule of how we're going to feel about things. Are we talking recruiting yet? We don't have anything else
Yeah,
on
we
the
have
field to talk about, right?
transfers.
Oh.
Edge Maurice Himes, punters Jack McAllister and Adam Saul indicated they plan to submit notifications to transfer when the portal opens.
Dual
All
puncher
in
strategy will work someday.
one.
Punchers.
McAllister apparently is going to remain with the Huskies to punt in the bowl game.
There we go.
Although it would have been kind of fun to just go without a punter.
No puncher. I said that the Seahawks should do it earlier, so.
You did advocate for it. The Huskies, to replace them, signed Aussie punter Dusty Zimmer on Tuesday night to kick off their 29-player signing day. This class is rated number 22 by 24/7 Sports, number 18 by ESPN.
Really? Number 18 by ESPN. Okay.
Yeah, and the big news Wednesday was wide receiver Marcus Harris flipping from Oklahoma, joining his high school modern-day quarterback Dash Byerly in signing with UW.
So, I wanted to highlight a couple pieces, which about this class, I did a bunch of deep diving, and obviously that flip today was a big one. And somebody who, Marcus Harris, I think 247 Sports ranks him as like seventh in the class, not necessarily like a game changing type recruit, but I think the most important thing about recruiting overall is any individual player I mean, maybe there are a few small outliers. You can't really count on any individual player being like, that player is going to change the course of history for our program. Honestly, no matter how good they are, right? There are number one quarterbacks in the country who commit places, end up transferring. Maybe they're good eventually, maybe they're not. The thing that matters recruiting-wise is volume. And again, having the number one class in the country doesn't guarantee you're going to be the number one team overall. After, basically, after you wait out the attrition of transfers, you probably are left with some pretty good players. So
there's a pretty strong correlation overall between team recruiting rankings and team success.
Yes. And ideally, the better players, the more highly recruited players that you sign in the long term in the aggregate rather than individuals. People freak out over individuals, right? And I looked back at so many different recruiting classes for the Huskies. And I think the most important thing to take away from this class is it's hard to factor in Kalen DeBoer's last season class because some of it changed when he left. This would be the highest ranked recruiting class that Kalen DeBoer ever recruited at UW. Obviously, his Alabama class is better now, but this is a better class than any of the ones. And I'm assuming that's three seasons for Kalen DeBoer.
Yeah, it's not that many.
But it ranks significantly higher in a lot of ways. And I think this is the best class since Chris Peterson's last season. I want to say that he did the recruiting where they signed Roma Dunze. So overall, if you look at that class and some of those players, they turn into players who were impact players for the Huskies. If you pull any individual out, it's not going to matter that much. I liked how many interior offensive linemen there were. This team is going to be active in the transfer portal. Jed Fish saw the offensive line that we all saw, and everybody across the country needs offensive line, and there's no team that's set at offensive line. I think this team is going to be very active in terms of finding linemen because that's what's going to make Damon Williams the kind of player that we think he can be. Everybody knows what the most important piece is and where those dollars are going
to
go.
And they're in a better spot to do it because you mentioned the change after Kalen DeBoer left and losing three starting offensive linemen after that. Well, guess what? There wasn't very many other offensive linemen that were eligible for transfer at that period of time. Most of them had already committed. So it wasn't a situation where you could kind of go like for like. And now they're out there committing, recruiting with a full transfer window to do so.
Yes. Lowen Coleman Brusa, who is basically the lowest rated player that they signed per 247 Sports, his brother, also at Kennedy, happens to be the top rated player in the 2025 class, who's an edge rusher. So
how about that?
Not a surprise that he was coming here. I think he's listed as warm on UW right now, but it was something where it's like, you just hope that he has a good experience. There's so many different layers to what you're doing recruiting wise. I'm happy so far with what Jed Fish is doing. Like, you can kind of see it, how Jed Fish built Arizona as a program and the types of players that he was signing and having these conversations now to go and get the 22nd best class when UW wasn't the 22nd best program this last, they weren't the 22nd best team this last season, to be able to recruit that way, I think is pretty important. Obviously, there's some Big Ten schools that are better, but I'm pretty happy with this one. And I'm also happy with how many people on the lines there were. I honestly, quarterbacks, I could care less, right? I just think recruiting quarter, first off, Damon Williams is here. Second off, as I mentioned, every quarterback is transferring. If you want to find a quarterback, you can find a quarterback. They are out there if you're not set. I could care less about those. Oregon signed two, like, top, Achilles Smith Jr. was one of them. And then they flipped a quarterback from Cal.
You're so old.
I know. I was like, okay, Achilles Smith Jr. But I'm just like, are they signed like three receivers who are top 10? I'm like, y'all, like, somebody's going to go. Some of these players are not going to see the field. It wants me to, like, go to them. I understand they're being paid. And just be like, what do you think is going to happen right now when there are that many players? So I think UW, they didn't compete with themselves too much. Also, there are a lot of receivers in the class. There's going to be some attrition overall. Don't want to get attached to any individual player, but there's one player who I wanted to highlight. Are you aware of who this player is? Because I thought this was a hilarious story. His name is John Mills.
I'm not aware of this player, no.
John Mills was committed to the Texas Longhorns as of earlier this week.
I have seen that, yes.
John Mills flipped to the University of Washington. This was 2 days ago, I want to say. Not on recruiting day. Mills will be part of the fifth generation of the Ryan family to attend the University of Washington. the 6'6" and a half and 345-pound offensive tackle, will join his cousin, Jack Anger, who is a pitcher for UW, finishing his career in 2022. Jack's father, Kyle, rode at UW, and their grandfather, Joe Ryan, played football for Jim Owens in the 1960s, playing in the 1964 Rose Bowl. This is my favorite part about the story. Take all of that stuff. Already should have been committed to UW. Definitely shouldn't have been like, yeah, Texas is pretty cool, though.
I mean, maybe he was a UW fan during the Sark era.
This is my favorite part about this story. Washington's newest commit was at Husky Stadium several years ago when Washington's famed tunnel was named the Ryan Family Tunnel.
What?
The fucking tunnel is named for him.
What?
And he didn't commit here initially.
Okay, you know.
How in the fuck did he not commit right away to UW? It's like the stadium is named for him. Every single member of his entire family attended UW. But he was like, Austin, Texas sure is pretty nice. The tunnel, it'd be like, heck, Edmondson Jr. was like, yeah, I think I'm going to go to Oregon.
Well, first off, Texas is not the same degree as rival is Oregon.
But
Austin
still.
Austin is very nice in December. That's pretty wild.
The tunnel is named after him. It'd be like if Alaska Airlines didn't commit to UW.
So Kathy traces her UW. This is his grandmother. Kathy traces her UW roots back to her grandfather, who rode crew and graduated in 1903.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Hey, John Mills, you ended up at the right place eventually.
Look, it doesn't matter the order of things. Okay.
There are paths to getting here, but like, come on, John Mills. It's also their 22nd best class in the country. This isn't like, you know, fucking Toledo out there, right? Mm. Like, it's a place that every single member of your family from the time they were the Sun Dodgers to now.
It doesn't say that every single member of the family went, although it is a large percentage.
And tunnels after him. Anyway, I just thought that was a hilarious story. I was like, wait, what? The tunnel?
I saw that he flipped from Texas. I knew none of this other information, so I appreciate you doing the deep dive.
Isn't that incredible? Oh, I dived in on a lot of these players today. He was like, yeah, I had a good relationship with Brennan Carroll when they recruited me in Arizona. And I'm like, dog, none of that information is relevant.
He's literally going to be running out the tunnel.
He was like,
named for his grandfather.
He was like, I have to look up. They have the timeline on. Also, you see him, and I think he's somebody who, he's only an 88 per 247 Sports, but obviously had an offer from Texas and from Florida, Cal, Nebraska. If you're an offensive lineman that gets offered in Nebraska, you're probably pretty fucking good. So I think he's somebody who, there are certain players that the rankings don't necessarily grasp in the same way. These coaches know how good these players are. And if you take a look at him and his flowing locks and mullet, you know this is an offensive lineman, right? You are down for it. So I love that he was like, yeah, Arizona was my eighth offer. UW, weirdly, I think was not in the first round. Wait, where did UW offer? He took an official visit on June 1st. Maybe UW was late to offering him or something. And maybe there was a little bit of like, why didn't you recruit me earlier? And they showed up later. But I thought that was an incredible story. So definitely cheering for, oh fuck, I just closed the tab with the tickets for the USC game.
Oh no. Oh no.
Anyway, John Mills,
all the listeners gonna beat you to the
Husky. More than anybody else has ever been a Husky. John Mills, you are a Husky.
The mullet.
Remember
says,
that, Paulo. Hope you had fun at Duke for your year.
I think he did. The mullet says pass block in the front, run block in the back.
There we go.
I didn't determine which order that would go in. It worked either way. One last bit of UW football news. Jordan Schultz reported that UW football has hired the 33rd team, which was founded by former Jets GM Mike Tannenbaum, to assist with revenue sharing and player negotiations as consultants. The organization, it's also a website, but the organization part of it also, like the consulting part of it, also includes former Minnesota Vikings general managers Rick Spielman and Jeff Diamond, along with former Philadelphia Eagles vice president Joe Banner. So, look, this, we are very clear that as players are going to be paid directly, as the teams can be involved with these NIL deals, college teams are operating more like pro teams. We see Andrew Luck as a GM at Stanford in that role, and this is coming. And so good to have a lot of NFL experience to help you with that.
I think it's fine. Yeah, life is coming at college sports fast. So the other thing that I was looking at when I was looking at these previous recruiting classes was, I think, again, on the individual level, Denzel Boston, kind of a forgotten three-star recruit. Now, if he entered the portal, he'd be a very coveted player at a lot of schools around the country.
Don't even joke about it.
I'm just saying, like, recruiting, like, you just, if you look at the previous classes,
I'm aware
the players who had
what you're saying
on the field are throughout it. But two seasons ago, there was a three-star recruit coming out of college or coming out of high school and a three-star recruit in the transfer portal. And do you know what that young man's name is?
Michael Penix Jr.
Michael Penix Jr., a lower recruit in the transfer portal than Will Rogers, the eighth pick in the draft and savior of the Atlanta Falcons. So, again, we really don't, on a micro level, these players. But the funny thing that I saw was, I think Chris Peterson's last recruiting class had one single transfer in it. Yeah, how quickly it has gone from... This high school recruiting is kind of like, that's not the roster that you're seeing. I was looking at how many players were freshmen last year. I even knew who they were, honestly. And I think it was two. Decker DeGraff, of course, dog. Decker DeGraff.
You got to know him. More than that. That's, come on.
Who really had an impact on the season. And then Kamori House were the only two who were freshmen, high school freshmen, who really had. And then DeMons, who DeMond technically counts as a transfer.
Yeah, I suppose. There's some other freshmen. Like, wasn't one of Keith Reynolds and Rasheed Williams was a true freshman, right?
I do not think so, no. Well, maybe Rasheed Williams transferred also.
Oh, okay. Can I note something about Loewen Coleman-Brusa?
Yes.
I really want this to happen where a Kennedy Catholic player comes to UW and is just a successful player at UW.
Yeah.
It's been since Paul Arnold. It's been so long. Just somebody from the greater Seamount League. I don't know if Kennedy's even still in the Seamount League, but you know what I'm saying.
I would be fine if it was Loewen Coleman-Brusa, but I would also be fine if it was, let me look up his brother's name.
Why not both? Why not both?
Yeah, both together. Derek Coleman-Brusa. Derek Coleman-Brusa seems like the real deal. As far as a pass rusher when judging a literal child.
Rashawn Clark, I think, played a little in Peyton Waters this season at safety.
Yeah, but you're looking for people who played a little. I'm talking who had an impact, you know?
I guess you're also not counting Anna Muhammad was technically a transfer.
Oh, and he was a freshman also.
Right.
Yeah, so some of them just kind of came from Jed's class. I mean,
I know who Packy Finau is.
But yeah, Packy Finau played a lot.
But yes, people get so obsessed with these players when they're flipping as recruits and then they come to college and you really don't think about them at all.
Let me give you an impression of people on our CFB when somebody flips or something happens and they usually go to Oregon or Michigan or whatever. Oh my God. Oh Lord. That's right. I'm just like, y'all, please.
We may have to clip the video on that one. Okay. Let's wrap up with Seahawks looking ahead to this Sunday's game against the Cardinals as we near the two-hour mark here. some exciting news. The defense is rolling. And Uchenna Nwosu, a full participant in practice Wednesday, could be back in the mix as soon as this Sunday. So the Cardinals, I didn't feel like I needed to really do the deep dive on them because we played them 2 weeks ago. And they're still the same team. They actually went up four spots in DVOA after a 23-22 loss at Minnesota on Sunday, which is part of the reason they have four and away the best projection in the NFC West in the DVOA playoff odds. Something that obviously will flip if the Seahawks win this game and sweep the season series. They led that one 19-6 with 4:37 left in the third quarter and trailed only for the final minute and 13. They outgained the Vikings 406 to 273. But made a costly decision to settle for a 23-yard field goal on fourth and goal from the four with 3:23 left to push their lead to six. The Vikings responded with a 70-yard touchdown drive to win that game. Did you see any of that? Did that end after the Seahawks game, or was it simultaneous?
No, I found out as the Seahawks were winning that they lost. I think somebody posted the Discord.
I guess that, yeah, no, I do remember
like,
that now.
Oh, the Vikings blew it, or the Cardinals blew it. And I was like, oh, shit, because I kind of written it off. I was like, the Cardinals won, we need to win. You know, that was the mode that I was in because they were up big. And I was just like, I was so locked in on the Seahawks game. I saw basically no other football in the morning, which kind of is kind of the bad part about doing 10 a.m. start. But no, I saw none of it.
We mentioned that Aaron Schott's breakdown of the most improved offenses and defenses over the last 6 weeks as compared to the first seven. Cardinals among the most improved on both sides of the football in that span. The Seahawks game really stands out offensively. It's the only time since week four they've been held under 300 yards. And the Seahawks managed to make them one-dimensional, took away Kyler Murray's legs. And I feel like did you mention on the podcast last week that it didn't seem like he was even moving that fast?
No.
Okay. I don't know. I feel like that came up on the Discord or something. Like, he didn't even seem like a threat. And last week he had 7 carries for 48 yards in Minnesota. So he is just fine. That was the Seahawks defense.
Looking at this game, Kyler was 31 for 45, 260 yards, one touchdown, two picks. Like, is that a good game? Yes, the rushing was good, so it kind of pushes the QBR forward a little bit because he had the 7 carries for 48 yards. But
I mean, also one of the interceptions was like at the end of the game. It was
okay. It was
a meaningless play.
The thing that the Vikings did is they did a similar thing that the Seahawks did, which is basically Trey McBride's going to have catches. Look, if you have the best receiver in the league, in the world, of all time, he's going to get the ball, right?
You can't stop Trey McBride, so don't even bother trying to contain him.
The Seahawks basically let Trey McBride... They gave up everything to Trey McBride. I'm sure this wasn't designed necessarily, but they completely stopped. And that is part of when you're spying Kyler Murray in that way and you're trying to contain Kyler Murray. It's a little bit of like, think something is going to be open because of that. The Vikings managed to limit, it was 12 catches, but 96 yards. The yards per reception was nowhere near as high as it was against the Seahawks.
But the Seahawks also took away the Cardinals' other receivers, most notably Marvin Harrison Jr., who, 3 for 47 and 6 targets.
And the run game. Basically nothing available for them in the run game against the Seahawks, which the Vikings didn't do as well. I look at that game. The Cardinals don't, they're still the Cardinals.
I don't think, I'm not a believer in the Cardinals offense, despite, that Seahawks game being a bit of an outlier lately. I am now becoming a believer in the Cardinals defense.
Wasn't it that the Cardinals weren't very good stopping the run? Is that right?
No, it was the Jets weren't very good stopping the run.
It is interesting that the Vikings basically were just like, yeah, we're good. We're not running the ball.
And then
you
the
see
unstoppable
rushing stats in that game.
The unstoppable force, or the stoppable force, was stopped by the movable object.
It was 4 carries for Cam Akers, 5 for Aaron Jones, 2 for Ty Chandler.
That's pretty wild. And 31 dropbacks for Sam Darnold. 31 pass attempts. I don't know how many dropbacks.
It was an interesting way that they approached that game. I mean, obviously, it worked in the end. The Seahawks are going to run the ball more in this game. For better or worse.
Cardinals have not allowed more than 300 yards on offense in 4 weeks, same as the Seahawks. My biggest takeaway from this game is take the under.
Defense. Okay. I am personally, I think there are a lot of people writing off the 49ers in this moment, and maybe this is the hottest take, I guess. We're not playing the 49ers again. If you ask me apples to apples, who is a scarier team right now? In fact, give me the entire NFC West. If you ask me who's the scariest team right now, I think it is San Francisco. It's still the scariest team. I think people are pretty highly underrating what San Francisco is based upon a snow game. Losing, I mean, Jordan Mason to me was the biggest loss. Like, Christian McCaffrey, I think, was holding back the 49ers offense.
Which do you think was the biggest loss to my fantasy team?
Both.
Was it having Christian McCaffrey or Jordan Mason?
How many dollars do you have to spend on Isaac Grando?
I mean, it's already, well, yeah, I'm not going to say.
I didn't even bother putting in a claim. I felt bad in the Champions. I think I have like $99, but I was like, I didn't want to take him from somebody who's actually competing. So.
Oh, you mean like me?
Yeah.
I do not have $99 to spend on Isaac Grando.
I believe in the other league, which I have like a 5% chance of making the playoffs in. I had a $98 claim in. Have those flipped yet?
They have not flipped.
Okay. Well, I guess nobody's going to hear this podcast before it happens.
No, they might. It's plausible that you might.
Doesn't it happen? Well, if somebody has more than $98, fine. Be my guest.
I guess that's true. Yes. I'm not revealing the amount that I have in on Isaac Redo, but it is all the dollars that I have to spend.
Yeah, Jonathan Taylor, Tank Dell, Jaden Daniels. I guess those are only the three on bye. Man, this team is so good. It's really annoying that I'm not going to be in the playoffs. But I still am having a hard time getting there. Yes, maybe the Cardinals defense and Jonathan Gannon has kind of figured it out with that defense. Buda Baker's playing at a very, very high level. I think when you look unit to unit, I still think the Seahawks defense is better than the Cardinals are. And I think the Seahawks defense is better than the Cardinals are in this moment right now. And I think the Cardinals offense is probably a little bit better than the Seahawks because of McBride God. They're not that much better. And we've just seen this a lot of times of this type of Seahawks team going into Arizona, neutral conditions. Some of the stuff that Ryan Grubb wants to do might work out a little bit more than it has in these other places. And it's December and it's Arizona. And I just have good memories from that overall. For Seattle, I might not. But December in Arizona, honestly, if it was a Sunday night game, I'd feel even better about it. But I am personally feeling, going into this game, feeling pretty solid overall, despite the fact that DVOA thinks it's probably the exact opposite direction.
Yeah. I mean, gamblers have this basically is close to a toss-up, leaning Cardinals, and then with home field, they're -2.5. So, but they have been too low on the Seahawks now 2 weeks in a row, and we were sweating it out with the Jets for a period of time, but we were right to ultimately to be more confident in the Seahawks than Vegas was.
I mean, again, we're talking about the Seahawks defense against the Jets. You can't take away the face mask. They gave up 7 points on defense, more or less. They played a pretty excellent game overall. Kyler Murray has been turnover prone, and the Seahawks have been pretty good at creating those turnovers. I know it's something that you can't necessarily count on, but when you look at this pass rush and just how many different players, it's kind of what we talked about at the beginning of the season. And we definitely were not talking about Leonard Williams playing in the mix for defensive player of the year. I think they have a couple players. The Spoon is even deeper down on there. But early in the season where Leonard Williams wasn't that much of a factor and Spoon wasn't that much of a factor, Mike McDonald has them playing at an extraordinarily high level right now. If it's going to be a defensive battle, it might come down to one or two plays. I feel like this offense is going to have a breakout game at some point. They're close to it right now. They're going to figure it out. Like they've really understood Jaxon Smith-Njigba in the past game. And I think Ryan Grubb is understanding things a little bit more. The offensive line is still extraordinarily bad, but those short yardage and leverage plays matter. The game against the Jets is not as close as it ends up being if they can pick up a fucking yard.
I would say if you're going to talk about turnover prone QBs, that Geno Smith is still a concern in that regard. He has twice as many interceptions as Kyler Murray and one fewer total fumble. Although I don't know how many of those are like involving the snap.
Oluwatimi, since he's been the starter, no notes.
I mean, the first game he had a snap issue, but since that, yeah, have not really noticed him, which is the best thing you can say, I think. Percentage chances of victory?
62%.
I'm still at 50-50. I mean, they are on the road. I think Arizona's a little better than you're giving them credit for. But it's a lot of playoff chances on the line, depending on which way that one swings.
I mean, this game is kind of every Mike McDonald knows it too. He talked about it this week in his press conference that he was like, we're going into a road playoff game right now. And that's what this game is for all intents and purposes. The Seahawks need to win. And if they win, they're in a very good position for the division. If they lose, it's a complicated road. Obviously, there's more games after that. And I do think Arizona, something like, it's strange that we're talking about Arizona as being the favorites when I look at Carolina on December 22nd and I'm like, that's a loss. or that is a losable game. I mean, I think the Patriots is a losable game too. You know, the way that like Drake May has been playing, that one's at home. They're probably going to win that one. But I'm not convinced yet on Arizona. They've got a couple of blowout victories, but they just have found a way to lose some of these games.
They certainly handled the Jets much more easily.
It was at home. There's a difference. They didn't fumble. They didn't give up a kick return touchdown and fumble the ball three times on kickoffs. Kyler Murray is 22 of 24 in that game. Holy crap. It was almost Damon Williams-like numbers.
I mean, that could be another comparison for Damon Williams Jr.
Yeah.
He's bigger than Kyler Murray.
Number one pick in the draft.
I'm aware. You that compared him to the number four pick in the draft and the guy who's the MVP of the NFL. I think Kyler Murray is a lot more fair comparison than Lamar Jackson.
I also compared him to Bo Nix. Positively to Bo Nix.
Bo Nix.
Look how far we've come.
Look at us.
All right.
On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.